Picture this. You are walking into a patient's room. They are post-op thoracic surgery, maybe day two. They're doing okay. Vital signs are stable. You're feeling pretty good about your shift. But then you hear a pop.
Oh, that sound. The sound no one wants to hear.
You look down and your stomach just drops. The chest tube tubing is lying on the floor. It has completely disconnected from the drainage system unit. The patient is looking at you, eyes wide, starting to panic, gasping a little.
That is the absolute nightmare scenario. I mean, that is the moment where time stops, everything goes into slow motion.
Right. And the question, the one that decides if you pass or fail on the NCLEX, and more importantly, if that patient stays safe, is what is your very first action?
Right. What do you do in those first 5 seconds?
Exactly. Do you clamp it? Do you run to the nurse's station, call the doctor? Do you scream for help? Do you grab a handful of gauze and just, hold it there?
This is such a classic moment where the real world and the exam world collide. The NCLEX loves to test your panic response. It wants to know what your instinct is.
And if that instinct is wrong,
If you don't know the sterile water trick immediately, you are going to mark the wrong answer, and you might actually compromise the patient's safety in real life. It's that critical.
we are going to answer that question and cover a whole lot more today. Welcome to the deep dive. We are digging into the material from nursingnotes.org to act as your audio mentor. I'm here to keep things moving and ask the questions that I know I'd be thinking if I were staring at that disconnected tube.
And I'm here to help us unpack the clinical reasoning behind the answers. Today, we are doing a deep dive into the fundamentals of care.
Fundamentals. It sounds basic, Is it basic? Because fundamental sounds like introduction to handshakes or something.
It sounds basic, and that's the trap. It is actually some of the most high-yield material on the entire exam. We're looking at material that covers health assessment, safety, infection control, and perioperative nursing.
So really the core of what a nurse does every single day.
Exactly. According to the Pyramid to Success, in our notes, safety and infection control are priority focus areas. This isn't just about fluff. This is about passing the exam and, keeping your license.
The pyramid to success. I like that. It implies a climb, but also a view from the top. So our mission today is to take these basics and turn them into points on the board for you.
We want you to feel confident with this stuff.
We've got a lot of ground to cover everything from how to listen to a neck without causing a stroke, to the scariest diseases you might encounter, to the math question that everyone dreads.
Let's get into it.
All right, let's kick things off with subtopic one, physical assessment. Specifically, what the notes call the do not touch zones. Now, I remember in school practicing head-to-toe assessments, and you just kind of poke and prod everything. You feel the lymph nodes, you feel the pulses.
Right, you're trying to be thorough.
But there is one spot on the neck where you really, really need to be careful.
You're talking about the carotid arteries.
Exactly, the carotid artery trap.
This is a really common concept on the exam because it ties directly into perfusion and safety. The rule is simple, but the physiology behind it is critical. Never, ever palpate both carotid arteries at the same time.
So why? I mean, I have two hands. It seems efficient. If I want to check symmetry, why not just do it simultaneously?
It is efficient if your goal is to make the patient pass out.
Okay, fair enough.
When you palpate the carotid, you are pressing on the main blood supply to the brain. Think of them as the two major highways for oxygen going to your cerebral cortex.
Got it.
If you press both sides simultaneously, you can compromise that blood flow to the brain essentially all at once.
Yeah.
You're creating a temporary roadblock on both highways.
So you're literally starving the brain of oxygen for a second.
For a second, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not just about stopping the blood flow mechanically. There's another layer to it. You can trigger something called a vagal response.
The vagal response. That's the rest and digest nerve, right? Vagus nerve.
Exactly. The 10th cranial nerve. The carotid artery has these tiny sensors in it called baroreceptors that measure pressure. When you press on them, you're tricking those sensors into thinking the blood pressure is sky high.
So you're sending a false signal to the brain.
A very powerful signal. The brain gets this message that says, emergency, blood pressure is too high. And its immediate reaction is to fire the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve then tells the heart to slow way down and the blood vessels to dilate.
So you're causing a sudden drop in heart rate and blood pressure?
A potentially dangerous one. If you do that on both sides at the same time, you can drop their heart rate so low they become bradycardic or cause syncope.
And syncope is the clinical term for passing out.
Correct. So you've got this patient you're just trying to assess, and suddenly they're slumping over in the chair. Not ideal. So the rule is palpate one at a time, gently, Feel the pulse, release, then go to the other side.
Okay, so we are palpating one at a time. Gently, but we aren't just feeling them, we are listening to them too, right? Because the neck can make noise.
If there's a problem, yes. And this is another key assessment skill. This is where auscultation comes in. You use the bell of your stethoscope, and you are listening for a very specific sound called a bruit.
Bruit, spelled B-R-U-I-T. It sounds French.
It is. And what you're listening for is turbulence. It's all about the physics of blood flow. In a healthy, wide-open artery, blood flow is silent. It's what we call laminar. It flows smoothly, like a calm river.
Okay, so silence is good?
Silence is golden in a carotid artery. But if there's a narrowing, say, from atherosclerosis, that plaque buildup you hear about, the blood has to squeeze through that narrow gap. And just like a river hitting rocks, it gets turbulent. That turbulence creates a sound.
And how would you describe that sound? If I'm wearing my stethoscope, what am I hearing? Is it a click? A thump?
The source material describes it as a blowing, swishing, or buzzing sound. Some people say it's like a hum.
Blowing, swishing, buzzing. Okay.
Basically, anything that isn't silence or a clean pulse beat. If you hear a swoosh swoosh sound that's timed with the heartbeat, that's your red flag. That swoosh indicates blood flow turbulence.
And if we hear that swoosh, what's the move? Do we like massage it or something to break up the plaque?
Oh, definitely do not massage it.
Okay, bad idea. Got it.
A very bad idea. Mm. You could dislodge a piece of that plaque and send a clot straight to the brain, causing a stroke.
No.
No. If you hear a bruit, your job is to document it and notify the healthcare provider. A bruit is not a normal finding in an adult.
So it's a diagnostic clue that something bigger is going on?
A huge one. It necessitates follow-up because it suggests vascular disease and a significantly higher risk for stroke.
Got it. So on the neck, palpate one side at a time and listen for a swoosh. Silence is golden. Swooshing is bad.
Perfect.
Now, let's move down from the neck to the lungs. Respiratory patterns. This is an area where, I'll be honest, the terminology gets incredibly confusing. You have all these terms that sound like 19th century doctors' names.
They often are. Chain, Stokes, Kussmaul, Bayeux, lots of names. But on the exam, they don't care if you know the history of the name. They expect you to be able to distinguish between them based on the pattern, the rhythm, and the involvement of apnea.
Apnea being the absence of breathing.
Exactly.
Let's start with the big one, chain Stokes. This seems to come up constantly in practice questions.
Chain Stokes is the one you really, really need to know, Colt. It's characterized by a very specific, predictable cycle. You have respirations that wax and wane. They get progressively deeper and faster. Then they get shallower and slower.
It's like a crescendo and decrescendo of breathing.
That's a great way to put it. And then importantly, that period of shallow breathing is followed by a period of apnea. No breathing at all for maybe 10, 20 seconds.
So it's breathing, breathing, getting deeper, getting shallower, silence. And then the cycle just restarts on its own.
Exactly. It's rhythmic. That's the key word here for the NCLEX. It's not chaotic. It has a pattern. And clinically, this is often associated with pretty serious conditions like metabolic dysfunction, heart failure, or issues in the cerebral hemispheres of the brain.
Is this the one you sometimes see in end-of-life care?
It is. You'll often see this in patients who are actively dying. It's sometimes colloquially called the death rattle pattern, though that's a bit unscientific. But it's a sign of significant central nervous system depression.
Okay, so chain Stokes is rhythmic with apnea. What about something called neurogenic hyperventilation? The name sounds pretty self-explanatory.
It is, for the most part. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's regular, rapid, deep, and sustained. There's no waxing and waning. It's just fast and deep, like the patient is running a marathon while lying in bed. This usually indicates an issue deeper in the brain, specifically the low midbrain or upper pons.
So it's less of a pattern and more of a constant state of overbreathing.
The constant state, yes.
Yeah. And then we have ataxic respirations. Ataxic sounds like taxi, but I assume it has nothing to do with cars.
Right. Think of the word ataxia in other contexts, like an ataxic gait where someone is stumbling and uncoordinated. Ataxic breathing is the respiratory equivalent of that. It's totally irregular.
So no pattern at all?
None. The rhythm is irregular. The depth is irregular. It's completely chaotic and unpredictable. This is a very ominous sign because it indicates dysfunction in the medulla, which is the brain's primary control center for breathing.
So chain Stokes is a pattern. Ataxic is a mess.
Precisely. And just to round it out, because you might see it, there's apneustic breathing. This one's a little weird. It's an irregular pattern, but its defining feature is these long pauses at the end of inspiration or expiration. Like the person takes a deep breath in and just holds it for a few seconds before breathing out.
That sounds exhausting.
It is. It indicates a problem in the pons, another part of the brainstem.
Okay, so for an NCLEX tip here, if the question stem describes a rhythmic cycle with periods of apnea, what are we circling?
Chain strokes. Every time. That combination of rhythmic and apnea is the classic description.
Perfect. Let's keep moving through the body. Heart sounds. We talked about the carotid brute. Now we're listening to the ticker itself. We all know, lub-dub, right? S1 and S2, that's baseline.
That's the normal baseline, the sound of the mitral and tricuspid valves closing, then the aortic and pulmonic valves closing. But for the exam, you need to be able to identify the abnormal sounds by their description alone, because you won't get an audio clip on a multiple choice test, usually.
Right, they have to describe it in words. So hit me, what does a murmur sound like in a test question?
A murmur is very similar to a brute just located over the heart itself. It's caused by turbulent blood flow through the heart valves. Maybe a valve isn't closing right, which is called regurgitation, or it isn't opening enough, which is stenosis.
So it's that same swooshing concept.
Exactly. It's described as a blowing or swooshing noise. The question might add more detail. Faint or loud, high-pitched or low-pitched, but blowing and swooshing are your keywords for a murmur.
Blowing and swooshing. Okay. What about a friction rub? That sounds painful.
It is. A friction rub is a completely different mechanism. It's caused by the pericardial sac, the sac around the heart being inflamed. The two layers of the sac, which should glide smoothly, are instead rubbing against each other with every heartbeat.
And what does that sound like?
The sound is described as scratchy or leathery.
Scratchy or leathery? Like rubbing two pieces of new leather together.
That's the perfect analogy. Or like rubbing sandpaper. It's a very grating, superficial sound. So if the stem says swoosh, you think murmur, which is a valve problem. If it says scratchy, you think friction rub, which is a pericarditis or inflammation problem.
I love how specific these descriptions are. It's like wine tasting, but for bodily functions. I'm detecting notes of leather and scratching with a hint of inflammation.
It sounds funny, but those adjectives are the key to the right answer. The NCLEX will use those exact words. If you mix up swoosh and scratch, you miss the diagnosis and the question.
All right, let's shift gears. We've assessed the patient. Now we need to keep them safe. Subtopic 2 is safety, and specifically the no restraint environment. This feels like a huge shift in nursing culture over the last 20 years or so.
This is huge, and the exam reflects this shift. It places a massive priority on what we call a no restraint policy, or least restrictive environment.
Meaning we just let patients do whatever they want. If they want to pull out their IV, we just watch.
No, absolutely not. But it means that physical restraints, tying someone down, using wrist restraints, posy vests, things like that, are the absolute last resort. You have to exhaust every other possible option first.
Why the big change?
It's a legal and ethical minefield to restrain someone. It strips them of their autonomy and dignity. And frankly, restraints can cause harm themselves. Skin breakdown, nerve damage, psychological trauma, even strangulation.
Mm-hmm.
So the default is now, how do we keep this person safe without tying them down?
Okay, so let's get practical. I have a patient who was confused, maybe post-op delirium or dementia. They're climbing out of bed. They're pulling at their IVs. In the old days, maybe you'd just restrain them. But for the exam, what are we doing instead? This feels like a classic select all that apply moment where we need a whole checklist.
It absolutely is. You need to have a toolbox of alternatives ready to go in your mind. First, look the environment. Can you orient the client? Tell them where they are, what day it is. Is there family around? Encouraging family or friends to stay with the client is a fantastic safety intervention because a familiar face can be incredibly calming.
Okay, so reorient, bring in the family. What else?
Supervision, direct supervision. Use sitters or patient safety attendants. These are staff members whose sole job is to sit in the room with the patient one-on-one and keep them safe. Redirect them. Talk to them.
That's very resource intensive.
It is. It's expensive for the hospital, but it's cheaper than a lawsuit from a fall with injury. And it's better for the patient.
That makes sense. What about where the patient is located on the unit?
Location matters immensely. If a patient is confused or a high fall risk, you assign them to a room near the nurse's station. You want them where you have eyes and ears on them constantly. Don't put the confused patient at the very end of the hall where nobody walks by for an hour.
Right. Out of sight, out of mind, and then out of bed.
Exactly. Also, think about sensory stimuli. Sometimes confusion comes from sensory deprivation or overload. At night, it's dark and quiet and scary. Give them appropriate visual and auditory stimuli. A nightlight. A clock so they know what time it is. A calendar. Family pictures. Familiar items from home help ground them in reality.
I saw a note here about bothersome treatments. What does that mean?
This is a critical thinking point that the NCLEX loves. You have to ask why the patient is agitated. Maybe they are pulling at a nasogastric tube because it's uncomfortable, it hurts, or it's just annoying.
Okay, makes sense.
So before you restrain them for pulling at the tube, ask yourself, do they still need it? Can we eliminate the bothersome treatment? If you can call the doctor and get an order to discontinue the NG tube, you remove the source of the agitation, and suddenly you don't need restraints anymore.
That's smart. It's about treating the cause, not just the behavior. Now, I've heard about hourly rounding. Is that part of this whole strategy?
It's a cornerstone of it. Many facilities use a structured approach, often called the 5 P's of hourly rounding. Every hour, you proactively go into the room and check on the patient, addressing 5 specific things: pain, potty, positioning, possessions, and problem.
Pain, potty, positions, problem. Okay, pain, potty, positioning seem obvious. Break down possessions for me.
Possessions means, is there water within reach? Are there glasses on the table next to them? Is the call light in their hand? Is their phone where they can get it? A huge number of falls happen because a patient is trying to lean way over to reach for their glasses or their phone, and they lose their balance.
So you just anticipate their needs and put everything right in their lap, essentially.
You put it within easy, safe reach. And problem is just an open-ended, is there anything else I can do for you right now? If you address all those things proactively, you take them to the bathroom, you reposition them so they're comfortable, you give them a sip of water, they have no reason to try to get out of bed unsafely on their own.
So on the exam, if I have a question about a confused patient and the options are apply wrist restraints versus move patient closer to nurse's station or offer toileting every 2 hours.
You are always, always, always picking the non-restraint options first. Restraints are the nuclear option. You have to prove you tried everything else first.
Always. Got it. Speaking of safety, let's talk about falls specifically for a moment. Besides the rounding, what else are we doing?
Bed alarms are crucial, especially for patients who are impulsive. You also have to do a thorough medication reconciliation. So many drugs can cause confusion, orthostatic hypotension, or dizziness, especially in the elderly. Things like benzodiazepines, opioids, some antihypertensives.
So you might need to talk to the provider about adjusting their meds.
Absolutely. And maintaining regular toileting routines. A lot of falls happen because a patient really, really needed to go and didn't want to wait or bother the nurse.
The famous, I thought I could make it on my own maneuver.
Exactly. If you can prevent that urgency, you can prevent the fall.
Okay, let's move to subtopic 3, infection control. The scary diseases, as our notes call them, the source material specifically highlights Ebola or EVD. Why Ebola? It seems so rare.
It is rare in most parts of the world, but it represents the highest level of infection control awareness. It's a high-stakes, low-frequency scenario. The exam wants to know if you can identify a potential public health threat and contain it instantly. It's a test of your public safety mindset.
Okay, so what are the red flags for Ebola? If someone walks into the ER, what makes you think, uh-oh?
You're looking for a specific constellation of symptoms. A fever, specifically 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Which is 38 degrees Celsius or greater, then a severe headache.
Muscle pain.
Profound weakness. And the classic sign that really separates it from, say, the flu, unexplained bleeding or bruising.
Bleeding from where?
Anywhere. Bleeding gums, nosebleeds, petechiae, which are those little pinpoint red spots on the skin. If someone comes in with flu-like symptoms plus bleeding, your Ebola radar should go up immediately.
Okay, so fever, pain, weakness, and bleeding. Now, the patient is in the ER. You suspect Ebola. What is the isolation protocol? This seems like a very specific detail they'd test on.
It is, because it's not just standard isolation.
Yeah.
First, you need a private room, but not just any private room. It absolutely needs a private bathroom.
Oh, that's interesting. Why the dedicated bathroom? Usually, we just care about the air or contact in the room itself.
It's because of the transmission mode. Ebola spreads through direct contact with blood, body fluids, secretions, and excretions. We're talking vomit, stool, urine. It's all highly infectious. You cannot have this patient walking down the hall to a shared commode or bathroom.
So containment is key.
Complete containment. You need a private bathroom or a covered bedside commode that stays in the room. And the door to the patient's room must stay closed at all times.
Door closed. Private bathroom. Got it. Now that's for Ebola. Let's zoom out to standard precautions. This applies to everyone, right? Not just the scary diseases.
Correct. Standard precautions are the bare minimum for every single patient, every single time. It's based on the principle that all patients are potentially infectious.
And it applies to what, exactly?
It applies to blood, all body fluids, secretions, excretions, except sweat, non-intact skin, and mucous membranes. Basically, the simple rule is, if it's wet and it's not yours, don't touch it without gloves.
If it's wet and it's not yours, don't touch it without gloves. Words to live by in nursing.
Absolutely. And part of standard precautions is hand hygiene. It sounds so basic, but they will test the when. When exactly do you wash your hands?
I feel like the answer is always.
Pretty much. But specifically, you wash hands between client contacts, after contact with any of those body fluids, and this is the one people sometimes forget on tests, immediately after removing gloves.
Right, because gloves are not magic shields. Your hands can still get contaminated while you're taking them off.
Exactly. Micro-tears in gloves can happen, or more commonly, you touch the contaminated outside of the glove with your bare skin while you're peeling it off. So you take the gloves off and you immediately wash your hands or use an alcohol-based sanitizer. Always wash after doffing.
Okay, we've covered assessment, safety, and infection control. Now let's talk about perioperative nursing. This is subtopic 4, complications, when to run.
Or rather, when to call for help very, very quickly. Perioperative care is a huge part of the pyramid to success because this is a period of high vulnerability for patients. You need to be able to spot the difference between a patient who is just groggy from anesthesia and a patient who is actively crashing.
Let's start with the big one. The one everyone worries about after, say, a big orthopedic surgery, pulmonary embolism or PE.
This is a top-tier life-threatening emergency. A PE is a blockage in the pulmonary artery, which is the main vessel carrying blood to the lungs to get oxygenated. Usually it's from a blood clot that traveled from the deep veins in the legs, a DVT.
What does that look like? If I'm the nurse, how do I distinguish it from something like pneumonia or just post-op pain?
The key word is suddenly. It happens suddenly. Pneumonia builds up over days. Post-op pain is usually localized to the incision. A PE hits like a truck. The patient will complain of sudden severe trouble breathing and sudden sharp chest pain or upper abdominal pain.
Sudden. Okay, so if a patient was fine 5 minutes ago and now they can't breathe, I should be thinking PE.
That should be at the top of your list. You'll also see other signs of hypoxia. Cyanosis, that bluish tinge around the lips and in the nail beds. Tachycardia, the heart is racing to try to compensate. And eventually, a drop in blood pressure as the heart starts to fail.
So sudden shortness of breath and chest pain, what is the priority nursing action?
Your number one job is to recognize it and get help immediately. Notify the surgeon or call the rapid response team. This is an all-hands-on-deck emergency. While you're waiting for them, you'll raise the head of the bed and administer high-flow oxygen, but your priority action is to alert the provider because this patient needs immediate medical intervention to dissolve that clot.
Okay, so PE is sudden respiratory distress. What about hemorrhage? Bleeding out.
Hemorrhage is another major post-op fear. It can be insidious because if it's internal, you might not see any blood pooling in the bed. So you have to be a detective and look for the signs of shock.
And what's the very first sign? Is it the blood pressure dropping? I feel like that's what everyone thinks of first.
That's what a lot of people think. But actually, no. By the time the blood pressure drops, you're pretty late in the game. The body has some amazing compensatory mechanisms. The first sign is often much more subtle. It's restlessness.
Really? Just being antsy or fidgety?
Yes. The brain is the most sensitive organ to oxygen levels. If you are losing blood, your blood volume is decreasing, and you aren't carrying enough oxygen to the tissues. The brain gets hypoxic, and the patient gets anxious, agitated, restless, or they might express a sense of impending doom. They just feel like something is terribly wrong.
So if a post-op patient who was calm starts acting fidgety and scared, I shouldn't just tell them to take a deep breath and calm down?
Never. That is a massive red flag. You need to immediately check their full set of vitals. When you do, you'll see the neck signs.
Mm-hmm.
A weak, rapid pulse. The heart is beating fast to try to move the remaining blood around. And then later, you'll see the hypotension, the low BP, and cool, clammy skin.
And there's another one here in the notes. Reduced urine output. Why is that so important?
Because the kidneys are incredibly smart. They are constantly monitoring blood flow. If blood volume and blood pressure drop because of a hemorrhage, the kidneys go into preservation mode. They clamp down and stop making urine to hold on to every last drop of fluid to try to keep the blood pressure up.
So it's a compensatory mechanism that also happens to be a huge warning sign.
A huge one. Low urine output in a post-op patient is a major, major red flag for hemorrhage or developing acute renal failure. You have to report that immediately.
Okay, so we've got PE, we've got hemorrhage. Now let's go back and answer the question from our hook, the chest tube.
The chest tube disconnection. The big one.
Okay, scene recap. The tube pops out of the drainage system. And to be clear, it's not out of the patient's chest. The tube is still in the patient. But the tubing itself separates from the collection box on the floor.
Right. And the risk here is that the chest tube system is a one-way street. It lets air out of the pleural space, but not back in. When it disconnects, you've just created a two-way street. Air can rush back up the tube and into the pleural space, recollapsing the lung. That's a pneumothorax.
So my first instinct might be to clamp it, just pinch it off to stop the flow. Is that the right move?
No. That is a very dangerous move and a common wrong answer on the NCLEX. Clamping is dangerous. Think about it. If the patient still has an air leak from their lung and you clamp the tube, that air has nowhere to go. It builds a pressure inside the chest and causes a tension pneumothorax.
And that's much worse.
That's a medical emergency that can kill them in minutes. The pressure pushes on the heart and the great vessels, and they can't fill with blood. So never clamp a chest tube unless you have a specific order or you're in the process of changing the entire system, which takes seconds.
Okay, so no clamping. We don't just call the doctor and wait for them to come.
No, that's too slow. Air is moving now. You have to act now.
The answer is the bottle of sterile water.
Exactly. You immediately take the contaminated end of the tube and you place it into a bottle of sterile water or saline. You hold the bottle below the level of the patient's chest.
And how does that help? What's the science there?
It creates an immediate makeshift water seal. It reestablishes that one-way street. Air can bubble out of the tube into the water. You'll see it, blah, blah, blah. But the water creates a barrier that prevents air from going back up the tube into the patient.
So you've reestablished the negative pressure seal just with a simple bottle of water?
You have. It's an incredible life-saving MacGyver move. Get me a bottle of sterile water, stat.
I love that. And it's a favorite exam question because it's not just about knowing a fact. It tests if you understand the physics of how a chest tube actually works.
Precisely.
Speaking of post-op, let's talk about labs. You're reviewing a patient's chart before they go to surgery. What's a lab value that stops the show?
The source notes specifically mention hemoglobin. Before any major surgery, a routine screening usually includes a complete blood count, a CBC. If you see a preoperative hemoglobin of 8.0 GDL, you must report it.
And normal is what? Roughly 12 to 18, depending on gender?
Exactly. Normal is roughly 12 to 16 for women, 14 to 18 for men. So an 8.0 is very low. It means they are significantly anemic and have a much reduced oxygen-carrying capacity in their blood.
And if they go into surgery like that?
If they lose even a little bit of blood during surgery, which is expected, they have no reserve. They could become severely hypoxic and crash on the table. The surgery will almost certainly be postponed, or at the very least, they'll need a blood transfusion first. You cannot safely send that patient to the OR.
Got it. Red flag on the 8.0 hemoglobin.
And going back to urine output for a second, just to put a number on it post-op, we are watching that urinary output like a hawk. The source emphasizes that while temperature and BP might fluctuate a bit, low urine output, usually defined as anything less than 30 millimoles per hour from adult, is a hard stop. You report that immediately.
Okay, we have saved the patient from a PE, a hemorrhage, and a collapsed lung. Now we have to do math.
Math question. It's inevitable. There will be at least one on your exam.
Subtopic 5. 5V flow rates. I feel like everyone panics when the little calculator icon pops up on the screen.
Don't panic. The key is to stay calm and know the formula. You are usually calculating drops per minute, which is GTTmin. This is for when you are running an IV by gravity without an electronic pump.
Which still happens, so what's the formula?
It's always the same.
Yeah.
The total volume you need to infuse in ml multiplied by the drop factor of the tubing in GTTmL. And that whole thing is divided by the time for the infusion in minutes.
So volume times drop factor divided by time.
Correct. And the key variables will always be given to you in the question. The drop factor is based on the type of IV tubing you're using. It will say the tubing is a drop factor of 15 GTTML, or maybe it's microdrip tubing at 60 GTTML. The volume is how much fluid is in the bag. The time is how long the doctor wants it to run over.
And the final answer is how many drops I should be counting as they fall in that little chamber every minute.
Right. So if you have a 1,000 milliliter bag of normal saline to run over 8 hours, well, first you have to convert 8 hours to minutes. So 8 times 60 is 480 minutes.
Always convert to minutes. Got it.
And let's say the tubing is 15 GTTML. So you do 1,000 milliliter times 15, which is 15,000. Then you divide that by 480 minutes.
And here is the most important tip from the source material, maybe for the whole deep dive. Use the on-screen calculator.
Yes. 1,000 times yes. Do not do this in your head under pressure. Don't do it on your little scratch paper if your handwriting is messy. The test provides you with a tool. Use the tool.
Yeah.
Do the math, then clear it and do it again to double check. It's an easy point to get if you are careful, and a very, very easy point to lose if you are sloppy.
Use the calculator is the best advice I've heard all day.
It's there for a reason. Don't be a hero.
All right. We have covered a ton of high yield content. Physical assessment, safety protocols, infection control, perioperative emergencies, and math. Now it's time to see if it all stuck.
Let's do it. Time to test that knowledge.
It's time for the rapid fire checkpoints. I'm going to throw a scenario at you, listener. I want you to pause for a second and think of the answer. Then our expert will give you the verdict and the rationale. Ready? Question one. You are teaching a male client about testicular self-examination. The NCLEX wants to know, when is the absolute best time for them to perform this exam? Take a second.
The answer is after a warm shower or bath.
And why the shower? What's the physiologic reason?
It's all about anatomy and temperature. The warm water relaxes the scrotal skin and also relaxes the cremaster muscle, which is the muscle that pulls the test up closer to the body when it's cold. When everything is relaxed and hanging lower, palpation is much easier and more effective for detecting any abnormalities or lumps.
Makes sense. Warm shower, relax the skin. Question two, you need to administer a cleansing enema to a patient who is constipated. What specific position do you place them in? Think about the anatomy of the colon.
The answer is left Sims position.
That's lying on the left side with the right knee pulled up toward the chest, right?
Correct. Sometimes called left lateral Sims.
Why specifically the left side? Why not the right?
It's all about gravity and the natural flow of the bowel. The sigmoid colon and the descending colon, which is where you want the enema solution to go first, run down the left side of the body. By laying them on their left side, the solution flows by gravity in the natural direction of the bowel. If you lay them on the right side, the fluid has to fight gravity to get where it needs to go, which is less effective and more uncomfortable.
Great rationale. Question three. You are assessing a patient's breathing. You observe a pattern of rhythmic respirations that get deeper, then shallower, followed by a distinct period of silence or apnea. Then the cycle starts all over again. What is this pattern called?
That is the classic description of Chain-Stokes respirations.
And the rationale, why isn't it ataxic?
The key is the rhythmic, predictable nature combined with the periods of apnea. It's a pattern. This is distinct from ataxic breathing, which is totally irregular and chaotic with no pattern at all. The exam will use the word rhythmic to clue you in to Chain-Stokes, which is often associated with metabolic dysfunction or cerebral hemisphere issues.
Perfect. I'm going to add a bonus one because we talked about it and the distinction is so important. Question four, you are listening to the heart over the pericardium. You hear a sound described as scratchy and leathery. What is it?
That is a friction rub, specifically a pericardial friction rub.
And it is not a murmur.
Definitely not a murmur. A murmur is a swooshing sound caused by turbulent blood flow through a valve. A rub is a scratching sound caused by inflamed surfaces rubbing together. Swoosh versus scratch.
Swoosh versus scratch. I love it. Those keywords are everything.
They are. On the NCLEX, it's those simple distinctions that get you the right answer.
Okay, that was intense. Let's all take a breath, a normal, non-Chain-Stokes breath, and do a quick recap. What are the absolute top things we need to walk away with today?
Takeaway number one, safety first. The exam is obsessed with safety, as it should be. In this no-restraint era, you have to prioritize alternatives. Move the patient near the nurse's station. Use sitters. Do your hourly rounding. Remember the 5 P's. Restraints are always the last resort after everything else has failed.
Takeaway number two, the disconnection rule. Burn this one into your brain. If that chest tube breaks loose from the system, don't clamp it, don't panic. Grab the sterile water. Submerge the end of the tube to create an emergency water seal. It prevents the lung from collapsing.
Takeaway three, listen carefully. Your ears are diagnostic tools. You need to know the language. A swooshing carotid is a brute, which means turbulence. Rhythmic apnea is Chain-Stokes. A scratchy heart sound is a friction rub. Don't mix them up. The descriptions are your clues.
And takeaway four, report the red flags. You are the surveillance system for your patient. If you see sudden dyspnea, think PE. If you see a pre-op hemoglobin of 8.0, you have to stop the surgery. If you hear silence where there should be breath sounds, or you notice a sudden drop in urine output, you must speak up immediately.
Exactly. The theme that runs through all of this is vigilance. The nurse is the one at the bedside who notices when things are starting to go wrong. Your assessment skills save lives.
You know, when we list it all out like this, fundamentals can feel like just this giant pile of random facts. You've got Ebola over here and then some math over there and heart sounds somewhere else. It can be really overwhelming for a student.
It absolutely can be. But you have to remember, the exam isn't trying to trick you with trivia. It's trying to make sure you are safe. Every single thing we discussed today, from not palpating two carotids at once to the sterile water to proper hand washing, is about keeping the patient alive and unharmed.
That's a really good perspective. It's not about memorizing a textbook for the sake of it. It's about building a safety net for your patient in your brain.
Right. And repetition is the key to making that net strong. The more you hear Chain Stokes associated with rhythmic apnea, the more automatic that connection becomes. On test day, you won't even have to think about it. The answer will just be there.
And if these concepts are struggling to stick, or if you just want a different way to lock this info into your long-term memory, you have to check out nursingnotes.org.
We've got some really cool, innovative tools over there.
We really do. We are the first and only resource that uses music-powered learning. We take these dry lists, like the symptoms for infection control or the cranial nerves, and we put them to a melody. It sounds a little crazy, but it actually works. It helps you remember more.
It leverages a different part of your brain, the part that can remember song lyrics from 10 years ago, but not what you had for breakfast. Plus, we have AI tools specifically designed to drill these scenarios. You can practice that chest tube scenario 10 times in a row until you get it perfect every single time.
Exactly. It's all built by nurses who have been through the NCLEX themselves. We know the struggle is real.
We absolutely do.
So keep studying. Don't let the sheer volume of information scare you. You are building the foundation of your entire nursing practice right now.
Stay curious, stay critical, and trust your gut when you see one of those red flags.
This has been the Deep Dive. Keep studying, stay confident, and go crush that exam.
You've got this.
See you next time.